Well, I'm really glad to be with you. I had planned on being with you this summer, and circumstances prevented me from being able to honor that obligation and privilege of being here, and I really appreciate all of your prayers as I went back to my home to be with my family and the loss of my father. But I had said to Dave, as soon as I can, I want to come back and visit and see if I can fulfill that commitment I had made to y'all. And so I'm very glad that God has allowed us to be together and to do this and to be here for this weekend. As Edwin told you, I have some experience in dealing with marriage subjects. I think probably the most important thing is I am married, and I go through some of those difficulties that all married couples go through. And I also am privileged to work in some marriage retreats, some weekends where couples get together, 50 couples get together, and share together in the Word and share our lives together and have some devotion time and some downtime and some social time. And I think we find out in those circumstances that what comes out of that may be the most helpful thing of all is that the difficulties that I experience in my marriage are not unique to me. They're difficulties that all married couples go through to some degree or another. It's not to say everybody's at the same level of discomfort or adjustment in their marriage, but that all of us have those difficulties. And it's always good to get in the Word. It's always valuable to get in God's Word, especially about this subject of marriage. And I'll tell you why I say especially about that in just a few moments. But I'm so glad to be here. I bring you greetings from your brothers and sisters in the Sunshine State, and particularly from those on the west coast of the Sunshine State, and from your brothers and sisters at Henderson Boulevard. You could have had it a little warmer for me if you really cared. This is cold for me. I called my wife today and she said, "Oh no, is it really that cold?" I said, "You don't know the half of it. It's really cold. I mean, it's cold here." But that's okay. It's sure warm to be among God's people here tonight. It's a joy. Most of us can recognize designer clothing. There are some designers that have certain colors that they use all the time. There are some designers that have certain insignias that will identify them as the designer of that clothing, so that when you see those clothes, you say, "Oh yeah, that's a Tommy Hilfiger, or that's a Polo, or that's a Ralph Lauren." Well, I recognize that because it bears the marks of its designer. And I want to tell you that I think what we really need to be working on is being the designer reflection in our marriage. That we need to have that in our marriages that makes us look like the marriages that God designed us to be. Because God made marriage. God made marriage. He created it. And in fact, beyond the physical creation of the world, marriage was the first institution God ever designed. It preceded the church. It preceded government. Marriage was the very first thing God instituted once He had the world in its place. So it's important to Him. He created it, and He is the sustainer of it. Not only did God create it and say, "Now you guys just kind of go out there and do what you want with it, make the best of it, experiment with it. If you don't like the way I've done it, find some other way of doing it." He didn't do that. God sustained marriage. In addition to having begun it, He said, "Here are the things that are important if you would please me and please yourselves in marriage. He continues to care about it. And even after the world is replenished, when he says to Adam and Eve, be fruitful, replenish the world, fill the world. Even after that, God still comes back again and again to talk about marriage and how important it is to us. And then I want to say one more thing about the design of God's marriage. His laws about it are unchanging. Now, I realize you may say, well, of course they are. But you need to know that our culture doesn't buy that. Our culture hasn't bought that. And I don't want to go into a lot of detail about this part of marriage, but we do need reinforcement of what marriage really is. I think that's absolutely critical, that we reinforce for our children and grandchildren what marriage really is. And we do that in a couple of ways. First of all, we do that by constantly going back to the Scriptures, like we're going to be doing this weekend. But in the second place, we do that by having the kinds of marriages that God wants us to have. I have said this about running. I don't run. I would run if something's chasing me. But I am not a runner. And somebody said, really, how come you don't run? And I said, well, you know what? I'll take up running the first time I'm in my car and go past a runner and they're smiling. Because they don't look very happy. I just got to tell you, runners don't look very happy when they're running. Well, my same thinking about runners is probably the thinking a lot of people have about marriage. You know, that our marriages aren't really good because we don't seem very happy about those marriages. It doesn't seem like it's a very good thing for us. It's like the woman that says, hey, you're not wearing your wedding ring anymore. And the man said, I know, I took it off. She said, well, you ought to wear it. And he said, why? And she says, so people will know we're married. And he said, what, this hangdog look ain't enough? If that's the kind of marriages we have, if that's the way we live, if we really have those kinds of marriages and we're unhappy in them and we're constantly breaking them up, shuffling people around and marrying others, if that's the way we live because we're not happy where we are, how can we expect our children to buy into that? There's no way. It's like sitting at the breakfast table and taking a sip of milk and going, I think this is spoiled. Taste it. Nobody else is going to taste that. Nobody wants to taste our marriage if it's not a good marriage. Nobody wants to experience that if all we have in that is pain. But when marriage is what God wants it to be, it's good. It's good. And people can see that it's good. And it can actually become, I do a lesson at some of our marriage retreats talking about how marriage is actually a tool for evangelism. Especially in a world where marriage is constantly breaking down. In a world where that's happening, people who have it together really stand out. In our culture, we're experimenting. People aren't happy with marriage as it is. So we do away with the till death do us part, and we just do it till we decide to do something else. We may not state it that way, but people live that way. Or we experiment with extramarital affairs in the marriage. Or we experiment with polygamy. You know, we're hearing more and more about polygamy. It doesn't surprise me, really, that polygamy is coming back. Because people are unhappy with the marriages they have. Why are they unhappy? Because they're not living the designer marriage that God gave us. And now we're seeing more and more in our culture, men living with men and women with women. And once that becomes accepted and approved, it's only a matter of time before somebody petitions the government for legitimizing polygamy. It's only a matter of time. I mean, honestly, if your argument is, well, as long as two people consent to live together in a marriage relationship, if they want to do that, who are we to deny them that? If that's the argument, then it's only a matter of time before somebody says, and if a man and four women, or a woman and five men, consent to live together in a married relationship, who are we to deny them that course of happiness or joy? Who are we to do that? Well, I don't know that we're anybody to do it, but I know what God said. And much of what God says really comes back to the very beginning. The very beginning of marriage. In Hebrews chapter 13, verse 8, the statement is made, and Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. But back in verse 4, just before that statement, is this statement about marriage being held in honor among all, and the marriage bed be undefiled. I'm going to tell you, if we could establish those two principles among ourselves, we'd go a long way toward the marriages that we ought to have. That marriage is to be held in honor. That it is to be considered a great privilege and blessing to be married. And that we do not defile the marriage bed. That we maintain the integrity of that relationship and the promises we have made to live with that person and to love them and them only. So open marriage, living together with no marital contract, polygamy, arranged marriages, all those are things that man devises to improve on God's plan, and they do not do that. But if we will build on the rock and build our houses on the rock, even as Jesus said in Matthew chapter 24, then when the storms come and the seas rise up against us, we will stand. That's what Jesus promised, if we will live our lives on the rock. So, go to Genesis chapters 1 and 2 with me, if you would, please. That's where we're going to kind of camp this evening in this, our first lesson in this series. In Genesis chapter 1 and 2, you have God making man as the culmination of all of His creation. I'm not going to go through and read all that, but you know that on the first day, He said there was light, and there was light, and He brought in the separation of the heavens, and He brought in vegetation and dry land from the sea, and all those things go forward, and He starts with the animals, and He ends with man on day 6. Now, chapter 2 tells us He really ends with woman, but woman is made in a little different way, and we're going to talk about that in a few moments, but basically, man of humanity, man is created first, and man is created alone. Have you ever wondered why that is? I mean, doesn't that seem kind of odd? Because He didn't do that with any of the animals. With all the animals, He created them in pairs. He made the animals and put them all out there. And He put a bunch of them out there. I mean, so many of them out there that He didn't have to say to them, animals, replenish the earth. I mean, it appears that maybe they were just in abundance everywhere. But He made, in contrast to that, He made one man. He didn't make a man and a woman at first. He made man first, and He made man alone. Have you ever pondered why that might be? I mean, why didn't He go ahead and make them both a pair to begin with? And I think there are good reasons why He didn't do that. Why He made man first and made man alone. Let me give you some reasons. Number one, the principle of the firstborn. We, in our culture, don't think quite as much about this firstborn principle as they did in biblical days. But it still holds true. In fact, God says of Jesus that He has the right to rule because of the principle of the firstborn. How many of you here are firstborn children? First in your family. Raise your hands if you are. Firstborn children. Okay? I'm not just holding my hand up by example. I am the firstborn in my family also. If you're a firstborn, if we were to take this room and divide it up, we sometimes do this at our marriage retreats. We say, if you are a firstborn, go to this corner. If you were a middle child, any middle child, go to that corner. If you're the baby in the family, the youngest, go to that corner. And if you are an only child, go to that corner. We divide them up. And then we ask them questions about themselves. We say, name three things that are great about being where you were in birth order, and name one thing that was bad about that. And it is so interesting to watch those groups work. Because the firstborn children get right on it. I mean, they are in control. And so they work on that together as a group right away. You can hear them. They're quiet. The babies, they're partying. It's like somebody told them, go party. They're over there laughing, talking. The middle children, they're quietly doing their work and looking around to make sure everybody else is okay. And the only children, of whom in our culture there aren't quite as many. You know, we went to one marriage retreat one time where we said, and all of you who are only children, go to that corner. And I got busy with some other things and looked back there. There was one woman. One woman back there. I said, I am so sorry. She said, I'm used to it. I'm used to it. There is something about birth order that we oldest children somehow feel responsible for everybody else. But that's not without design. God kind of intended things to be that way. In Genesis chapter 5, when you have this litany of the people of God as they have given birth, you'll see this over and over and over again. And Adam and Eve gave birth to Seth. And they had other sons and daughters. And then Adam dies. And then it picks up with Seth. And then it tells who Seth's firstborn child is. And then it says, and had other sons and daughters. But in each case, the firstborn is the one through whom the lineage is traced. That is not intended to say that the others aren't important. But there is something very important about the firstborn child in the Bible. And I'll tell you what I think it is. In Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 17, there's this scenario painted for the children of Israel in which a man is married to two women, and he has a loved wife and an unloved wife. And the unloved probably would be better translated, the lesser loved. That's why a man doesn't need to have multiple wives. You shouldn't have to make those kinds of decisions as to whom he loves more. No woman would be happy with a statement, you know, well, there's only one woman I love more than you. No woman would be happy with that. And I doubt very seriously that a woman would be happy and comforted if her husband said, I love you. Now, I love this other woman just slightly less, but I love you more. It says, if the unloved woman or lesser loved woman gives birth to the first child, that the man is not to assign the place of the firstborn to the children of the woman that he prefers. He must give the rights of the firstborn to the firstborn. Because they bear the responsibility. It says, here's how it says it, for he is the beginning of your strength. And when you look at that phrase and you see it in other places, you begin to realize what it's saying is he has the responsibility of carrying on your family. That weight is on the firstborn in the Bible. Now you may be saying at this point, I'm not sure I understand what this has to do with marriage. Stay with me for a few moments because it does. It has a distinct bearing on this. The oldest received more because they bore more responsibility. It wasn't a matter of qualification. It was simply a matter of birth order. It wasn't a matter of the firstborn's always the one more capable of leading. He was given that responsibility simply by birth order. And that birth order was so significant that seconds made a difference. Seconds. In Genesis 25, Esau exits the womb just slightly ahead of Jacob, who even has his hand reaching out to cross the finish line before him, grabbing the heel of Esau to pull him back. And yet, because Esau's born first, he carries the privileges, the benefits, and the responsibilities of being the firstborn. Just seconds made a difference. Jesus is the firstborn of Mary. In Luke chapter 2, verse 7, her firstborn child. But there's even more than that. Jesus is also in Colossians chapter 1, verse 15, called the firstborn of all creation. And that has given people problems in the past. They think, wait a minute. What do you mean the firstborn of all creation? Was he a created being? That's not what it means at all. What that means in that circumstance is he carries the responsibility of the firstborn. Not that he was created, but that he has the position of primacy in the family. And what does that mean to you and me? Well, everything. It means he's over us. We, as the sons and daughters of God, yield to the rule and authority of the firstborn of God, Jesus himself. And it says he is the head over his body in Ephesians chapter 5, he's the head over his body, even as Adam becomes head over Eve. In that same way that a husband is over a wife, Jesus is over his body, his bride, the church. Adam is the firstborn to show the hierarchy in the family. Man is first in creation. Man is therefore first in headship. And he is first in spiritual responsibility. Now listen, I'm going to stress that. Men have a responsibility to lead their families spiritually. Being the head of the family is more than bringing home the bread. More important than that is bringing home the bread of life. It's your job, men. It's your responsibility to assume that. And it is given to you not because you're necessarily more spiritual or more knowledgeable or even older in the faith. You bear that responsibility because in the family, God made man first. And now when I say first in that context, I don't necessarily mean, I need to be older than my wife. It's not that kind of first. It's first in terms of responsibility and primacy. It's taking the first or prime place in your family. God made you that way. That's why he makes man first. He is saying something. It's not God makes man and then gets distracted and said, wait, there was something else I was supposed to do. There was somebody else I was supposed to create. I can't remember what it is. Oh, it was a woman. Okay, let me go back and do that. That's not the way it happened. God knows very well what he's doing. You need to wrestle with that concept until you come to a conclusion about that. Man bears the responsibility in the home. And man will show that responsibility, or lack thereof, from the very beginning in this text. God named man. Adam named him. God named Adam. Adam named all the creatures, and then Adam named Eve. named her woman first. Have you ever thought about that? Why didn't God name her? Why didn't God name her? He named Adam. He called him man. God made man. Why didn't God say, and here's woman? Why did he let Adam do that? Well, I'll tell you why. Because naming something is a means of showing ownership or responsibility. It's a way of showing that. In the Bible, parents name their children, and in many cases, name them with some kind of promise of what they would be. You would be very upset if I were waiting for the delivery of your first child, and you bore that child, and I went to the window and looked in, and I said, oh my goodness, she looks like Patsy. Let's call her Patsy. You'd say, hey, that's not your response. That's not your place to do that. You didn't bear that child. You didn't go through labor. It's not your child. Doesn't bear your genetic qualities. Or you didn't adopt that child. You can't name it. We did. It's ours. When God names the woman, he's saying something. And God is allowing man to name the woman. God lets that happen because there's a responsibility man is taking for that woman. Does that make sense? This whole thing as it's played out is more than just circumstance. There's design behind this. God makes man first and makes him alone. And then he names him man, Adam of the earth. He names him. And then when the woman comes along, God sits back there, puts his hand over his mouth. What are you going to call her? Adam looks at her. I mean, I wish there are some scenes in the Bible I wish I could have been present for. I got to tell you, this would be one. I don't know if Adam had looked at himself in water, you know, looked at a still pond and saw himself before Eve came. I don't know if he recognized what he looked like. I wonder, what did Adam look like? The first man ever created. The perfect male. What did he look like? What color was his hair? What was the tone of his skin? What did his teeth look like? I've got to tell you, I can't imagine God would have made him and immediately said, he's going to need orthodontia. Come here, let me fix those real quick for you. I can't imagine that. He was perfect. He was every perfect feature God wants. Our forebearer had. He was exactly what God makes. The prototype. That's what he looked like. Now, and if he's that way, I got to tell you, as a man, I really wonder, what did Eve look like? I guess probably more, I probably would say, I wonder who she looked like. Because I can only compare it to women that I know. Was she tall? Was she short? Did she have long hair? Was it curly? Parted down the middle? Did she have bangs? What color were her eyes? She's the perfect woman. The perfect woman. So, it's no wonder what Adam said when he saw her. Whoa, man. Woman. Can you... I just can't even imagine what that meeting looked like. I mean, she's so different than him. All of that very obvious to him. He's big and strong and muscular and she's soft. He sees her, and this is his. And he claims her and names her, "Your woman, because you're taken out of the man." That's what he says about her. And then later he calls her Eve. Eve, the mother of all living. Because we're all descendants of Eve. All of us. Every one of us. Probably not... Well, in the garden it may not be a big deal, but when she starts bearing children and there's pain in that, she's probably not as happy having been named the mother of all living. But he knows what her role is going to be. She's going to be a nurturer and a protector of her children in that way, because that's her function in the relationship. Men don't give birth to children. Haven't. We're not capable. Even if we wanted to, we couldn't. Women do that. And then he will bear this great responsibility for her. I want you to notice, you remember, we'll jump in the story just ahead for just a minute to chapter 3, where Eve is in the garden and she is the one who will eat of that tree. And as a result of that, who gets the heaviest punishment? It's Adam. Now, I know Eve will secondarily bear some of that, but God really comes down hard on Adam. I mean, he will really, really nail him. Why? Because Adam's responsible for their spiritual welfare. Adam should have taken the lead in that, and he didn't. They are a couple in this situation, but God blames Adam. If you look at chapter 3, verse 17, "Because you've listened to the voice of your wife." Because you listened to her. You shouldn't have listened to her. You should have been talking to her. You should have been telling her. You say, well, he didn't know. Yeah, he did know. He knew exactly what she was doing. In fact, I'm going to contend the text indicates he watched her. He saw her reach up and take that fruit. And he didn't say to her, don't do that. And if he had been the spiritual leader he should have been, he'd have slapped it out of her hand. If he had to. He would have prevented her from eating that. He didn't. And it is stated, she took from its fruit and ate, verse 6. And she gave also to her husband, what? With her. Her husband with her. I got to tell you, for the longest time, I never saw that. I always pictured that story. There's Eve all by herself walking along. Serpent says, come here. You've got to try this fruit. I'm telling you, this is the best. And he convinces her. And she eats it. And she goes, "Woo, this is good. I got to go find Adam. I got to find him. Adam, where are you? You got to taste this." And he says, "What is it?" "Oh, it's a fruit." And Adam just eats it, not knowing, just eats it. And then, boy, there they go. Oh, no, not that. That's not the way it was. That's not the way it was. The text says he was with her. He was standing there. He let it happen. He allowed her to eat that fruit. And then more than that, he took it. She said, "Oh, Adam, this is delicious." And he said, "Okay." And he took it. He listened to her when she should have listened to him. He didn't speak up about that. And so because of that, I mean, he really gets it. "Cursed is the ground because of you. All the days of your life, thorns and thistles, it will grow for you. You'll eat by the sweat of your face. You'll return to the ground. You'll go back to the dust." And then get out of the garden. Man, why is God so hard on him? Because he failed to be the firstborn. He failed. Men, you can live your life unto yourself until you marry. And then you take on the responsibility for your family. You take on that responsibility. It's your job. You become the spiritual head of your household. This, from the very beginning, God willed that such would be so for us. And so, the very first thing, the principle of the firstborn, is why Adam was created first. Now let's answer the question, why Adam alone? Why did God make him alone? Why didn't God just say, here's Adam, Adam, here's Eve, Eve, you listen to Adam, Adam, you direct Eve. Why didn't he do it that way? And I'll tell you why I think God made him alone. It is interesting to me that Adam rejoices that this woman came from him. I think that God is trying to show man, by creating him alone, show him his need for woman. You need a woman. You're not as full and complete and adequate as you would like to be if you're alone. You're not. I think that's what God is saying to Adam because of this scenario that plays out. You remember what happens? Chapter 2. Adam is alone. And God brings all the animals to him. And Adam names them. You ever wonder why they did that? Listen, think about that for a minute. You wonder why he did that? Why did God bring the animals to Adam and let him name them? And Adam sees what about them? That they all have pairs. There's a male and a female in every one of those. There's one and there's another kind. There's one kind and there's another kind. And they even look different. You know, they look different. A male lion looks very different from a female lion. And Adam sees that. And then he begins thinking, well, where's my half? Where's my other? Where's the one that corresponds to me? And it may very well be that in Adam seeing that in all others, he became very aware of his what? His aloneness. His aloneness. He became aware of it, and God says, that's not good. And it's not good for him to be alone. It's affecting him. That shouldn't be so. God's teaching Adam something by this. God's not making mistakes, failing to do things, turning responsibilities over to Adam because God doesn't want to do it. God could have named all the animals. Adam could have said, what's that? And God said, that's a bird. What's that? That's a tiger. What's that? God could have done that, but instead he said, I don't know. What do you think, Adam? Adam said, oh, it looks like a tiger to me. Good. We'll call it that. What's that? That's a glorified rat. That's a possum. In naming all the animals, Adam has an opportunity to see that they all are paired except him. And so he becomes alone and lonely. And God says, okay, now he's ready. He's not adequate to himself, and he recognizes that. And so I will make him a mate. And what is it? Listen, she comes out of him, but what is it he says about her? Bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh, she'll be called woman because she was taken out of the man. And for this cause, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and what? And the two shall become one flesh. She's taken from him, but the purpose is to bring her back to him so that the two of them become one again. And that's not, I'm going to tell you something. You misunderstand the text if you think becoming one flesh is a reference to the sexual union. It's not. It's not. Because that word for become one flesh is a continuing verb. They will continue to become one flesh. I'm more one flesh with my wife today than I was when I first married her. We are becoming more and more one in our thinking and in our goals and our purposes. That's the way it's supposed to be. A reference to the sexual union is the statement made in Thessalonians about being one body. Being one body is a statement of the sexual union. One flesh is a statement of the unity of mind and heart and soul that a husband and wife need to have with each other. It's that kind of reference. And they will become that. So the whole purpose is take her out of the man, and now let's work to bring her back into the man so that the two of them become one again. One united being. The two shall become one. And that's the unity of the marriage. A third reason why I think God made man first and made him alone is so man would understand where his mate came from. More than any other creature, man would understand God gave her to me. Do you think maybe it might change the way we think about our mates if we thought in those terms that this is God's gift to me? God's gift to me. We might treat that gift with a little more dignity. And we might be more thankful for what we have. And God gives man this first practical gift he ever received. The most practical gift man ever got came from God when he created woman. Because she's going to complement him. Look, this idea that she would be a help, meet for him, is this idea. Here's man, and he's got strengths, but he's got gaps. He's got gaps. Now, some of you women say, you're not describing my husband. He's got a lot more gaps than that. But he's got gaps. And the woman, she's over here. And she's got strengths, and she's got gaps. And God takes them and brings them together in this way, so that the gaps are filled. That's what it means when it says she was a help to him. Meet for him. It's not this. It's not that. It's not hitting. It's filling each other's gaps. Men and women are different. And there are some strengths women have that men don't have, and some strengths men have that women don't have. I think in our culture today, perhaps we are glorifying the strengths of the woman and denigrating and belittling the strengths of men in our culture. So that the men are the buffoons in TV programs. They're the not unknowing. They just kind of stagger through life and get through it as best they can. But the women all know. They smile and smirk at each other. Oh, that's a man. That's a man. Without realizing that men have great strengths God gave them too. And that when the two of them are brought together, he fills her gaps as much as she fills his. They're both very important to each other. We are. And we need to recognize those differences rather than throw our hands up in the air, you know, oh, why don't you think like me? I got to tell you, men think like I think. Men do. I don't want to be married to any of them. I want to live with them. They're fun to be with for short periods of time. But I don't want to live with them. They're too much like me. I'm so thrilled I have a wife that challenges me to understand her. I do weddings as all preachers do, and one of the things sometimes I say to the young man, either in premarital counseling or even sometimes in the wedding ceremony, I says, listen, I'm going to tell you, John, there are only two times in your life when you will not understand this woman. One is before marriage and the other is after marriage. Because we are different. We're different. And I've seen women as often throw up their hands and say, men, I don't understand that, as I see men doing that. But we're meant to complement each other, and that's a gift. God made her that way so they could complement each other. And I don't mean compliment as in, oh, you, I like your hair. Well, I like the way you smell. It's not that compliment. It's complementing, filling in the gaps of each other. It's the way God meant it to be. It's why He made man and woman different. And that is the means by which we glorify God in that relationship. I'm not saying you can't do it alone. If you start arguing that marriage is the only way you can glorify God, you leave Jesus out. I want to do that. But there is a special sense. Don't ever think marriage is just an alternative here that you could take or leave. If you like it, that's fine. If you don't, hey, that's great. Because it was the means by which God brought about all of us, many sons and daughters. And it is the means by which we glorify God. Ephesians 5 talks about that in those terms. That this also is part of the great mystery. That the man and the woman will live together as Christ and the church live together and glorify God together. Man and woman do that. So let me just give you one more thought and then we'll close. It's verse 26 of chapter 1. God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Now you notice that word, man. And then He says, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. God created man in His own image. In the image of God, He created him. Male and female, He created them. I want just offer this, the circumstances of the creation. It looks like bad grammar. It looks like bad grammar here. God said, let us make man, singular noun, in our image, and let them, plural pronoun. The point that He's making is, I'm going to make a man and a woman, ultimately. I know I'm starting with a man and I'm going to end with a woman. And there's reasons for that we've already talked about. But I want everybody to know that our purpose is to bring them together as a unit. That they are to work together, not independent of each other. They're meant to share their lives together. Now, I'm not saying you have to share absolutely everything in your life. But I am concerned about couples who pursue parallel tracks, rarely see each other, rarely talk about plans that unite them together. She's got her own account. He's got his own account. She's got her car. He's got his car. She's got her vacations. He takes his separately. They do everything they do together. They got different TVs because there are programs he likes to watch she doesn't like and vice versa. And she DVRs what she wants to watch and he takes care of the programs he wants to watch on another TV. And they live separate lives under one roof. That was never God's intent. The point He's making is, I am making man like us. God and Jesus aren't that way. The Holy Spirit and Jesus aren't that way, and the Holy Spirit and God aren't that way. Running on parallel tracks and periodically checking in with each other with a text or a phone call. They are united in their purpose. And so should the husband and wife. Now, when's the last time you sat down together? I'm not saying this to make you feel guilty. I'm not trying to indict you because I don't even know your particular circumstances. But when's the last time you sat down together and said, what are our plans? Not what are your plans, what are you going to do, but what are our plans? What is our future? What are we going to do with these children? And not said in exasperation, what are we going to do with these kids? But said really thinking in terms of your life and your plans for your life. They were united in their work. God put them in the garden, and they tended the garden. God told them to be fruitful and multiply. They reproduced together. Both of them are called man in verse 26. Both of them are given dominion. Listen, it says in verse 28, God blessed them and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the sky, over every living thing that moves on the earth. God gave it to them together. There appears to me to be only one law God gave to the man alone before the woman came on the scene. You know what that was? The law about the tree of knowledge of good and evil. He gives that to man before woman's born in chapter 2, before she's created. God tells the man that he is not to eat of that tree in verses 15 through 17. And it's after that that God creates the woman. What's the point of that? Well, man was supposed to pass that on to her and enforce it. God gave him that responsibility. And that is why his failure is great. And here's one more circumstance about this creation that's interesting to me. Two more thoughts. One for a moment and then one very quick. The lack of competition between the two. There's no competitiveness. Man doesn't look at woman and say, I'll bet I can beat you in a race. And she doesn't say, you may, but I'm prettier than you are. Or I'm smarter than you are. Or my verbal skills are significantly heightened. There's not a competitiveness. They work together. God created them to share together in their lives. I see couples that are competitive in unhealthy ways. She making fun of him because there are certain things he can't do. Or he saying of her, yeah, she's incapable of doing that. You know, it's going to take a man to do that. There was not that competitiveness in the families that God created. I think we need to be careful about that. Are there things women do better than men? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And are there things men do better than women? Of course there are. And, you know, our culture is working really hard to make us think there's no difference in men and women. Any of the differences that exist between them are only a result of our culture. It's just because we've made them that way. Don't you believe that for a minute. I'm not saying I could get into a boxing ring and take on the daughter of Muhammad Ali and beat her. She'd probably wail away on me pretty well. But I dare say she wouldn't come close to taking on a professional boxer of the male variety. And I don't believe there's a man in the room that would subject himself to the uneven parallel bars in gymnastics. There are some things women can do and some things men can do. And some things women do better than men and other things men do better than women. It's not a competitiveness thing here. It shouldn't be that way. They were meant to work together. And the last, final thought. It is beautiful to me how God says, let's make man in our image after our likeness. You want to see God? Look at a designer marriage. And you will see some of the qualities of love and sacrifice, of mercy and compassion and forgiveness that characterizes the God in whose image we are made. We'll talk more about some of those things if the Lord allows us to be together through the rest of this weekend. Thanks for listening so well. Edwin?